Our program this afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, are tips and applications for using drones and IR systems. Many of us in this room today have discovered new and exciting ways to use drones as diagnostic tools in and around our radio and TV stations. We find that drones can be extremely valuable for investigating a variety of systems and structures. This session will provide tips on drone usage and applications along with practical examples. Our speakers for our sessions are Gary Cavell and Cindy Hutter Cavell. Starting with Mr. Gary Cavell. Gary's been in the broadcast business for over 47 years and has his company efforts to develop and utilize drone platforms and IR technology for RF system investigations. Gary was the editor-in-chief of the 11th edition of the NAB Engineering Handbook, has served for more than 20 years as a faculty member for the NAB Leadership Foundation, and is a frequently invited speaker on broadcast technology. He is a member of SBE, a lifetime member of IEEE and SMPTE, and is the past president of the IEEE Broadcast Television Technology. But wait, there's more. Along with Gary, we have Mrs. Cindy Hutter Cavell. She is an industry award-winning expert who has been working in the television and cable industries for 44 years. She's presently working as the senior broadcast engineering consultant for the FCC's fund administrator for the 2 gigahertz relocation project. Some of you may have remembered that little item. In a prior life, Cindy was also an engineering vice president for several TV stations, including Hearst Argyle Television, Gannett, which is now Tegna, and Fox Television. She also served as vice president and manager of the Fox Sports Houston Network playoff facility. Her career includes several years with ABC and NBC News, traveling internationally on an on-location tech lead. Cindy was the 2019 winner of the NAB Engineering Achievement Award in television, the first woman to be so honored. She is also the recipient of the 2021 Broadcast and Cable Technology Leadership Award and was the 2015 winner of the Television News Check Women in Technology Leadership Award. Ladies and gentlemen, I present Gary and Cindy Cavell of Cavell Mertz.
Thank you. It helps to marry up, it really does. So, yeah, one of the few female engineers in the business, and she made it when it was even harder than it is now. So, ladies, pay attention. I am feeding back.
You're all right.
I'm all right. All right. We're going to be trouble. If you haven't seen this present before, I'm sorry, but we're going to be trouble. We're not politically correct, and he has a dump button, so we're good.
He goes rogue, and we never follow the slide deck. And I apologize for that up front. But I'm assuming that WBA will give you the slide deck in case you really want to know how this, all the boring bits. We're going to mix up the slides a little bit and not follow the order very well. How many of you in the room are FAA licensed Part 91 pilots?
Cool.
I figured as much. I don't know what it is about television and radio engineering and pilots, but it seems okay. How many of you fly drones for fun?
One, two, or three, four. Good.
How many of you are Part 107 certificated drone pilots?
Excellent.
A few more. Excellent.
You can straighten us out then if we screw up, okay?
Okay.
So what we're going to touch on is real quick is this is the basis of this is using the drones. We want to give you a sense of, I think it might be helpful, where we came from, how we got to this point, and the struggles we went through. So if you want to use drones for yourself, develop your own drone program, you can take this as some learning tools and call us. You'll find that the professional drone community in radio and television is very close and closed. If it weren't for a couple of colleagues we wouldn't be where we are today. So we help each other out. There's enough business to go around, so we're not going to be greedy about it. So ask questions, call up and say, how do you do? And we'll try to help you out. What I want to make sure you get from this is not only how to do the drone program, but why would you use a drone for a particular application, how to plan the mission, because you will crash your drone more than once. That's why God made insurance. And we had a $50,000 incident, which was all our drone got killed. We didn't kill the guy wire. The drone hit the guy wire due to a moment's inattention on the pilot. In fact, I'll go off offline, because I always do. We had this mission plan. It had an autopilot. We flew the system fine. And one of the technicians on the ground said, what if we flew it closer, because I have a question. Fine, we can do that. Typed it in, did the mission, didn't think to plan about where the guy was, or they didn't move, but the mission moved, boom, splat, 50K later.
That was a $20,000 mistake.
Yeah. So that's, like all engineers, we rush to the fire to put it out, even if we're going to get burned. They rush to the fire to put it out, and they killed my drone. So when you're doing a mission with a drone, pay attention to everything. It is like working in a high voltage section of a transmitter. You really have to start paying attention, and if you get distracted or if you're tired, stop. So that's one of the takeaways from this thing here. Things we use it for, you can certainly visually inspect the tower. But there are hazards, which we'll talk about when you do visual inspections of towers. You can do it for tower mapping, what antenna is where. Because many of the drone packages have GPS systems on them, barometers on them, altimeters, ways to tell where you are in height and laterally. So you can do a fairly good job of mapping what's on the tower and even zoom in and see what is that, and is that cable kind of hanging loose? And I see this cable going up from the ground, but where the hell does it go? It's just kind of hanging. So this way you can have an intelligent use of a tower climber. Yeah, go up to 237 feet, I think there's something loose there, as opposed to what do you see? And he'll know what kind of tools to take with him. We've used drones for signal measurement, for doing, is there that birdie, is that a deliberate interferer? Is it a bad bolt on a tower? Is it somebody who's a pirate? What's this intermod we're seeing? You can triangulate just like the FCC would using drone technology. It's just an antenna that you mount. Antenna pattern verification, that's something we've been doing a lot of. And infrared scan of RF components. We've been doing infrared since, I guess, 2001, and drone since 2016. So it's still a new business.
So, there's a lot of development that goes into a professional signal measurement drone. The first thing you have to decide on is the platform. What kind of platform are you going to use? Largely depends on what you want to carry, how versatile you want it to be, and what, basically what you want it to do. You can build your own, and all of us know as engineers, we love building stuff. A colleague of mine at NBC would take a $2,000 item, spend $50,000 worth of manpower on it so that it could do almost as much as the $10,000 off-the-shelf thing.
But it's better.
It's funner, but it's not necessarily better. So do you build your own, or do you go out and buy something that's appropriate? How much payload do you want to carry? What kind of battery technology are you using on the drone, and what kind of life does it have? I mean, standard battery life for what we do is about 20 to 25 minutes full out, and we never, ever use them full out. We always use them down to about 20%, and then we land them.
You need the room to maneuver. It runs out of battery, okay, it'll land all right in a big smoking hole. You need to have enough energy left to maneuver past the hazards and safely land. And if there's a wind gust or something wacky happening, you need to have the battery power to get where you need to go. So never run the battery down, slam to the wire. It's not good for the battery, and the drone will fall out of the sky, out of control.
Yeah, that's not a landing, that's a crash. So what we did, we've got pretty much three drones in our fleet right now. The one in the middle is the oldest. We hand-built that. It was a lot of trial and error. We snapped that landing gear off about half a dozen times landing it. We've snapped the rotor blades off of it at least once. And we have a mechanical engineer on staff who literally designed and hand-built the enclosure for the electronics to RF harden it. And all of that took a couple of years of trial and error.
And John Keen, who you may know, one of my colleagues, he designed filtering systems not only for the RF receiving system and the computer that's on board, but also for, is RF getting into the motors? Is RF getting into the control systems? Is it getting into the telemetry? So we had all kinds of kludgematic boxes. You'd be proud. It was really, really Rube Goldberg. And that's where, I guess it was 2016, 2017, we saw some guy online who was also doing measurements with drones, a guy named Jason Schreiber with six arms. And we reached out to him and said, hey, we're trying to do this here in the States. What are you doing? And he opened right up and collaborated with us, gave us some of his examples of successes and failures. And he did some Rube Goldberg stuff just like we did. And so that's what I said, people will share. So this guy in Australia is helping us. Other people we've talked to over the years have helped us. Manufacturers have helped us. I don't know if anybody from ERI is in the room, but we took some of our earlier drones to the test chamber at ERI, putting our antennas on it, say, gee, does a drone affect the pattern of the receiving antenna? And tested it 8 ways from Sunday. And we had success with working with Dielectric on other things, which we'll touch on later. So it's a community of people trying to find answers, which is pretty cool. So that the doors are open for questions, always. Us, with Jason, with other people.
All three generations of these drones are super flexible. You can take the antenna off the top and hang an IR camera on the bottom, or you can hang a video camera on the bottom. We've had custom-made antennas done for FM and television, and we have one for the cell service, but we haven't used it yet. So they're super flexible and super configurable, and we built them that way on purpose. So what's a drone? The FAA calls them SUASs, or Small Unmanned Aircraft Systems. If they are less than half a pound, they're a toy. And if they're more than 55 pounds, they're an aircraft. So in between half a pound and 55 pounds lies what we all know as SUASs.
And there's two flavors. You have, if you're going to do this commercial, you get a Part 107 certificate. We call it license. FAA calls it certificate. That's a top left sample. If you're doing this for fun and for grins, you have to have a license or a certificate from the FAA. You have to take a test, which is, you can't flunk it. It's a pretty easy test to get a trust certificate. And you have to carry that on you, and it's renewable every 2 years. So that's if you're just a fun pilot. If you're doing this for profit, then you need to get the regular Part 107 license. And doing this for hire, that may mean different things. The FAA is like the FCC. They have these funny, twisted little minds. So if you have a drone and your buddy owns a radio station, I'm going to go out and measure the antenna by a guy that's fun, the FAA will consider that as possible compensation. You're doing it as a favor. This guy might buy you a hamburger. That's compensation. That's a commercial flight. Where is it going to be a problem? If somebody from the FAA shows up, or a cop shows up and calls the FAA and asks, or if you have an incident and somebody gets hurt or property gets damaged, they're going to start asking questions. So if you're doing this for grins and you don't have a license that says you don't have the training, that puts you in a different bucket of how they're going to beat you, as opposed to your trained person who did stupid stuff, I'm going to beat you this way. So if you're going to do this for money or for anything that smells like compensation, get the Part 107 license. So for hire, for grins, you got to have a 107 license. It has to be renewed every 24 months. You have to carry it on you. And the drones also have to be registered. That's probably the next slide. Yeah. The drone has to be registered, has to have its little number put on the side of the drone someplace where it can be seen. And here's a couple certificates for our drones. And those have a lifetime that you have to renew. And yes, you should insure these things, because you can hurt somebody. The drone propellers go pretty quickly and people can get cut badly, or you can damage stuff by landing on them. Rule changes. Got to watch out for rule changes.
And they spring them on you whenever they feel like it. The newest rule change is starting next year, all drones of all sizes between half a pound and 55 pounds have to have a transponder on them. And if, because they want to know where you are. It makes sense. I mean, those of you who are Part 91 pilots know that you need to have a transponder so that the FAA can keep you away from other guys who are flying bug smashers and larger.
So you have to be diligent about watching rule changes, and the FAA is even more difficult to follow than the FCC. So keep connected to the drone community if you're doing this on a regular basis. There's lots of groups, and also go on the FAA website and snooze through their stuff and try to keep track of stuff. Flight planning, you know, does it make sense to do this, whatever you're going to do with a drone? Sometimes it just flat doesn't.
And that could be for any number of factors. There may be no way to keep the drone from flying over people. There may be no way to keep a drone from flying over prohibited airspace. There may be no way to keep a drone from flying over sensitive military installations.
They get real touchy.
I mean, they're just physical impracticality too. I mean, nobody in their right mind is going to go to the city of Chicago and say, "Gee, I'd like to drone the antennas on the top of the Willis, on top of Willis."
They'll send you straight to hell, as will New York City if you're going to do the Empire State Building.
This is a city that can't get Willis helicopter time to change out the antennas up there.
So can the mission be done? And also RF. What are those frequencies? That's up in your frequency range.
you got to be super careful of, even though the drones that we use are RF hardened, you still have to be super careful of what sort of RF fields you put them in. We just came back from a little jaunt to Mount Wilson in California, where we successfully did an IR mission and a signal measurement mission. And the kid who was our pilot was flying that drone by hand the entire time because the 50 megawatts that sits up there on Mount Wilson was taking out his GPS.
So we had to rely on alternate sensors to give us altitude and positioning indications, and he would, instead of the autopilot, hand flying. The guy's steely good. I couldn't do it. If you ever have hand flown your drone with the GPS aid taken off, then you know how touchy that is. So that's. That was a sight. We said, "Okay, we'll do it."
But there are also a bunch of stories out there, right, about tower guys using unhardened drones. A friend of ours was doing a tower scan with a drone, and one of the telemetry frequencies on the drone is 5.8 gig. Well, what do a lot of STLs use? And he wasn't paying attention to what he was doing, and he flew that drone right past a 6 gig antenna, and it went, boom! All gone.
All gone, night-night. Nobody was hurt except his feelings and the drone.
There are sometimes the drone is just, you know, pick your tool. Pick the right tool for the job. Sometimes a drone is not it.
And if you are going to go use it, then, you know, where are you going to fly? What are the hazards? Where are the guy wires? Use Google Earth. It's your friend. Showing up early and taking a good look, does this still make sense? Sometimes you have to say no. Are there cable bridges that are going to be in the way? What's the escape path? You look at that stuff. When Big Brother is a factor, you need to, is it okay to fly where I'm flying? Am I going to be close to controlled airspace? That's a fancy aeronautical map up top. You pilots know this one. That's somebody's class Charlie. I think it's a class Charlie here at Madison for the airport. If you're going to fly in that kind of space, you need to, and this is all on the FAA website, but you go to a special program to get permission to fly in it, and they may let you, and it may give you a ceiling. Instead of 400 feet, you can only go 200 feet. So you have to go through the Lance program. Otherwise, you have to ask for a waiver. at Wilson, we needed a waiver. Waivers can take up to 90 days. We're from the FAA, we're going to help you get nothing done. It takes time to process any deviation beyond their rules. This is a copy, I think that was the Wilson waiver, of to let us do things that were not the normal Part 107 rules. That takes time. You have to write a long dissertation, and you go in a drone zone. It's all on computer, so it's got to be easy. But you have to tell them what they want to hear, the way they want to hear it. So it's doable, but you're going to do several cycles through to get it done, and you're going to get really cheesed off, and a lot of beer helps.
So a lot of you are wondering right now, okay, why do I mean, these people are standing up here telling us all sorts of reasons why we can't do it. Why even bother? Well, the answer to that is there is a keyhole in the FAA rules that allows for a 400-foot cylinder around a structure. The tower is a structure. So we can fly that drone in a circular fashion around the tower as long as we stay within 400 feet of it.
And 400 feet above the top of the tower. So you've got some wiggle room there to play with. So, and this is, you'll see this in some of your training videos. We won't waste your time on this, but this is stuff you got to worry about and check the weather and know you shouldn't go flying in a windstorm. And this, it'll be in a slide you can catch later. But the keyhole thing we brought in is if you have to fly further away for some technical reason from the tower, then you're going to start running into the FAA GNE to waiver. So again, look at the mission carefully for, is there a waiver involved? Or people, is it a bad idea because you have a nice shiny DJI drone and you're doing this for a defense agency? That's not going to happen. That's why we have three different drones, because one's New Zealand, one's Chineseium, and the other one is made in America. And you know, one of them will work on a sensitive area. We were tasked to do a radar mapping project, and that was easy. You fly the drone up, park it, and they spin the radar around, and you give them the data, done. So we didn't have to orbit it. They just spun it to see if the radars were making a problem. So why do you want to do this? We got calls for this for the repack. We are about to change an antenna out. What do we have now? And this is for FM, it's for TV. By the way, we can do AM measurements, but that's a different can of worms, and it's not accepted by the FCC, so we won't go there. Is there damage to the antenna? We're getting viewer reports, listening reports, all of a sudden over here, why? And maybe if you drone it, measure it, you can say, yeah, that the pattern's not what we thought it was. Damage, you know, somebody was practicing their target practice on your lights and it's a lousy aim and they got your antenna. So that, did something change? Do you want to check out what it is? So do you TDR it? Do you use a network analyzer? Do you run out with a field truck? How do you know, how do you quantify what's going on so you tell management, hey, we need to spend some money to look at this to maybe fix something that may not be there? You've all been there. The good news, and this is not a paid political announcement, although the manufacturers, if you want to give me extra money, that's cool. But most of the stuff works. Most of the antennas they sell you work. What we've seen over the past few years is people doing mistakes in shipping, people installing them wrong, people taking a big, long, heavy TV antenna and hoisting it from the middle, and it's going like this as you're jerking up the tower. That was helpful. So you have a bent antenna. So it's installation errors. One of the manufacturers quoted they're seeing 13% of the antennas installed have an issue, which that's a small number, but that's a big number. And usually it's the directional antennas because you notice them, they're critical. Most of those errors, though, are, again, installation where they're off a bolt hole or two and they've rotated it wrong. Or they put a phasing line in funny on a panel, so all of a sudden your antenna is performing badly. So you can see this pretty quickly with some of the drone measurements. Sometimes you can even see inadvertent mechanical beam tilt. The tower's not plumb. Why somebody's not checking that when you're putting in a new antenna, I don't know. But or they installed the antenna wonky. This, Carl, you've done a bunch of these. I keep picking on Carl because he used to be my business partner. See, I admit it in public. And Carl Long, PE, Michigan, whatever, anyway. Measurement from a ground-based vehicle, this is your friend, this is where you get a 30-foot mast, and you go up and you avoid power lines, bridges, right?
Say what?
You avoid power lines and bridges.
Yeah, you do, it's bad.
because if you have the Wilbert mast up and you hit a bridge, then bad things happen. Or you overpressurize the mast and anyway.
Yeah, it just happened to land in the through the roof of the cop car that was parked behind him. It wasn't good.
We don't talk about that. But anyway, stuff happens. So, but measuring with a mast with a receiving antenna mounted about 30 feet in the air, and you go do radial measurements away from the antenna to track its intensity, and it's like plots of 100-foot runs and then spot measurements, and you do collect an awful lot of data to see what the energy is at the reference height above ground using mast-mounted equipment. In ancient days, we used strip chart recorders and would mechanically write things down, and now spectrum analyzers and computers make it a bit easier, but it is a huge, huge hassle factor, and it's weeks of time for people to do it right. And you're sometimes in not the best neighborhoods in the world. They're not all just AM sites. They're terrible sites to go to. The good news is the FCC accepts this if you do it right. The bad news is weeks. And I don't know what's, you've seen these things go.
You're talking about 3 weeks of a consultant's time to do the measurements and write the report. And let's face it, it's all there was until recently. But it's horribly inefficient because it's not a direct measurement of the antenna. It's a measurement of field strength out in the field where there is urban clutter and agricultural clutter and all sorts of reflections and refractions and
local effects.
You're way outside the far field of the antenna to begin with. So it's a relative measurement, it's sort of kind of okay, but it's all we had.
But the FCC accepts it. So that's the one you came to the dance with, and that's the default for accuracy. The FCC now is starting to accept drones because they have reimbursed people for drone measurements. As far as FCC filings, we're not there yet. We're gonna have to go zoom,
yep.
If that's right.
Yep.
So we've done helicopters. You can tack an antenna to the side of a helicopter. The bad news is there's lots of wampum is required, lots of money you have to pay to have the aircraft modified. You gotta pay a pilot, you gotta run a helicopter. That's a lot of US dollars. It is good for getting an actual pattern measurement, but the big thing there is cost and timing. Some of you have worked, I think it was called Automat. You can go ahead and put it in your car and run around and measure field strength that way. That's not FCC submittable, but it can give you a good before and after sense of it. And again, look at the slide later on. Drone-based measurements are becoming more and more accepted. There's an ITU document supporting them, which again is on the slide and you go track down. This is a sample of what we would do.
Yeah, that is actually a Google Map representation of one of our flights. Basically, what you do is, in order to, we know where the license says the height above ground should be for the main lobe of the antenna, but we want to measure it to make sure. So we're going to make a bunch of vertical runs. In a couple of different compass points, so we can attest that the antenna is actually straight up and down when it's supposed to be and actually has a mechanical beam tilt when it should. And based on the elevation numbers we get on those vertical runs, we then program the azimuth pattern for both horizontal polarization and vertical polarization in an antenna if the antenna has both. And because we're doing that, and we'll get to that in just a minute, and talking about why we measure an antenna at the distance we do. And then you see one more elevation pattern run out way away from the tower, which is in the far field of the antenna. Because that circular pattern that we're ascribing closer into the antenna is in the near field of the antenna. Of the antenna radiation.
And there are formulas out there that show you how far you have to go. The trick here is you need to get far enough away from the antenna so that the beam is actually forming, you have a pattern being formed. If you get too close, you're in the reactive field, you're gonna be measuring garbage, you don't know what you have. Traditionally, you do the near field formula, the far field formula, Fraunhofer formula, to see how far out we can go. And sometimes you're talking about 2,000 meters, 4,000 meters, a long distance away. Then you get into issues like ground reflections can corrupt the data. the FAA won't let you fly that far away. It's a big issue. So we started to experiment with flying closer and closer and closer, and found that you could get often within that 400-foot radius the FAA lets you have and get good data. And we worked with Dielectric to doing a bunch of drone measurements to work with their new multi-automodal methods modeling program. And they've confirmed that the close-in measurements properly done do work to represent the antenna properly. And for example, if you hired somebody to do the drone measurements, you can then hire Dielectric to run their software and see if there's correlation. And most of the time it does. So it's, again,
What occasioned all of this is kind of interesting. It was drone technology coming to, I won't call it adulthood, but maybe teenage years. And the TV band repack happening all at the same time. And all of a sudden, we had a couple of thousand stations that were looking for an antenna verification measurement because they all wanted to make sure that the antenna was installed correctly, it was put up correctly.
And you couldn't do the field truck measurements quickly enough.
It was as advertised, and you can't do those kind of that number of truck measurements in any kind of reasonable time frame. So Harvey Arnold at Sinclair had the foresight to contract a drone company to do all of their repack measurements. And he and Gary are both pilots, and he called Gary one day and he said, my drone company can't get any of these done because every time we turn around, the FAA wants a waiver to measure these in the antenna far field. What are you guys doing to beat, you know, here we've got this 400-foot cylinder on each side of the tower. How can we do that? So Dielectric said, well, we model these antennas. So here's some antenna models. Can you guys, meaning us, go drone one of our known good antennas out in the field that we just put up at 400 feet away from the tower to see whether or not what you get on your drone measurement actually matches what we've modeled in the lab. And as you'll see from some pictures later on, it actually matches the model pretty darn well.
We probably should go to the cases of, yeah, here's the case of the horizontal. I'm gonna skip ahead to you. Here's an example of what went bad and what went good. The green is what the drone measured. The dashed line is what the manufacturer said it should be. This for a case where it didn't work. And obviously, that antenna is not performing as advertised. Let's go forward a bit.
These are not U.S. U.S. antennas. These come out of Australia.
Six arms to send us stuff because we didn't want to display your dirty laundry in front of you and your buddies. This is somebody else's dirty laundry in another country, so that's why Six Arms gave us this. But these are examples of antennas that are aimed wrong, just flat mounted wrong on the tower. And in a couple of cases, that's pretty ugly, particularly depending where your population is. You can have a phasing error in a harness-fed antenna, and it does oddball stuff like that. If you look at the dotted lines, what you're supposed to have, and the solid lines is what was measured. It can have some pretty terrible results, including an inverted panel. That was trying to put a big notch up there where it wasn't wanted. Of course, the city of license was that direction, so somebody noticed. So stuff can happen from the guys in the field assembling a thing wrong. If you do a scatter study, you will see when you're on a tower that's populated with other things, it'll have some ripples. And the drone studies show that, yeah, you can have ripple and distortion. And it confirms it. Sometimes the manufacturer makes an error. And that's when you need to put out your diplomat hat. If you measure something and it's like way wrong and there's no other reason, you inspect the antenna, you have a tower guy climb it. And there's just something wrong. Sometimes the thing was built wrong or designed wrong. And here's some examples of stuff that was built wrong, designed wrong. And it's hard to tell somebody their baby's ugly. And they're real touchy about it. So if you go up to somebody and say your antenna's performing badly. And of course, engineers are charming all the time. They know how to use diplomacy, right? the antenna doesn't work. It's like, no. We measured an anomaly. We'd like to share the data with you. Well, it's got to be wrong. You're doing it wrong. You go through all that stuff. And eventually you get to, oh, yeah, was a sign error or was something we did wrong in manufacturing a thing in the plant. So stuff does happen. Now, kind of shifting a bit, going to the thermography side, if you're doing antenna sweeps, you use a network analyzer, you look up the antenna's feed pipe, you know, is the antenna performing okay? Are there feed line problems? This works okay most of the time. The problem is it's easy to misinterpret a network analyzer if you haven't used it a lot. The other problem is, if you show my age, you take a Simpson 260 measuring something in a circuit. That looks good. Put it under power, doesn't look good. Why? This network analyzer is putting a few milliwatts up the pipe. If you put 20 kilowatts up the pipe, something's wrong. So how do you measure something dynamically? You can't do it easily with a network analyzer. So we turned in 2001 to thermal imaging. If we can measure the heat in something under operation, maybe it'll tell us whether there's an issue. So,
to put a fine point on it, in 2001, they were doing it with a very fancy, expensive, nitrogen-cooled IR camera with a fancy lens sitting on a tripod on the ground. It wasn't drone-mounted.
But if you paid for the bigger lens, you can get a nice long view and you can see things. I can go to the next slide. These are the drones. You can get a lot of drone cameras, that, you know, one that clips to your cell phone and one that's a little handheld. Those are good, and of course, like with anything, the more money you spend, the more capability and accuracy you have, so you have to judge what's the right tool for the job, and these are some of the ones we have. But here's an example of a problem. These are four television antennas. They're center-fed antennas, as a matter of fact, and the image on the left is one I like to use because it's a better one for analysis, but managers and owners like to see the pretty colors, so we'd put this in for client amazement. But white and yellow is bad news, like 100 degrees C above what it's supposed to be. So we saw this antenna on the second from the left, and take time for a war story. This is a entity that had a lot of processes. And we said, that's burning up. This is why you're having a VISWAR. This is why the VISWAR is kind of intermittent because something's burning. Well, are you sure? Yes, here's the proof. Well, that's kind of new technology. We need to have a board meeting and talk about it. Okay, you've got maybe 30 days. And they kept talking about it and doubting it. And that thing on the left is the antenna after it finally
said. Jeff Welton is not the only guy in the room that can say boom.
Boom, this went. Sorry, Jeff. He promised he'd be in here. He is. There you are, rascal. So anyway, yeah, that very expensive 3-ton TV antenna caught fire. And the fire department would just kind of stand there and look because they're not going to 1,500 foot in the air, spray hoses. It's like, okay. So it was replaced and it's all happy now. On the same job, we saw that antenna, that transmission line on the left, and told the FM station, hey, we happen to be out here and notice your transmission line in trouble. Yeah, I don't believe you. I don't have any VISWAR. Okay. And in 6 weeks, they were replacing that line. So can you go back one? This is a pretty good example of differences, and that elbow is living in sin. This elbow is living in sin, and it's going to give up on you. So you can see this quite comfortably that's several degrees C above what it's supposed to be. So you look for differences. You can go on to the next one. And again, the elbow's going bad, living wrong. You see carbon, fire, burn. Now, thermal cameras, as you experiment with yours, and we're talking to Jeff this morning, it's like any other sophisticated tool. It's easy to misinterpret. These two transmission lines here are the same temperature, but that one on the upper right looks hotter. It's not, it's just a difference in the finish. So you need to learn how to use thermal cameras properly. The FLIR is a good source of thermal cameras. They also have lots of training programs. Many of them are for free. They have webinars, they have paid courses. You can become master thermographers like me and some of my guys. So you get training, learn how to use the devices, and see what things are going on and what means something. Go ahead. A couple of case studies. Water-cooled tool on the left, water-cooled tube on the left, and on the right. The one on the right doesn't have enough water. That tube was about to fail from heat. Walked into a transmitter plant, you saw that box, it was hot. On the upper left, you open it up, and you saw, that switch is going bad. open up electrical boxes, make sure you have flash training. Next one. When Cindy was the chief engineer of Channel 5 in Washington, I found 90 amps of current on the neutral, and it was hot. That was the upper left.
We had 90 volts on the neutral.
90 amps.
And 90 amps, sorry, on the neutral. And the interesting thing about it is this all started because when I got there, the guy who was the chief engineer said, you know, every time we have a thunderstorm, we've got to unplug the microwave control cable. The tower was in the backyard. We have to unplug the microwave control cable to the tower or we fry everything in the rack.
Major market, Washington, D.C.
Sounds like a grounding problem.
After unplug the microwave in the middle of a storm.
So back in the mid-90s, long before I married this guy, I called Cavell Martz and said, can you guys come over here and do a thermal scan of our electric vault? Because I knew that we had a problem down there. And they found that upper right hand, I can't tell from upper left hand.
Yep.
And that was my neutral. That was my neutral circuit. That was the mains down in the vault. So it was obvious we had some issues.
There was a big imbalance in their feeds. They had building
they,
built.
Now, they solved it last year by moving the station.
Yeah, moved the station. But it could have been solved with an electrician with a brain and a couple of grounding kits, and it would be simple. The other two here, that's lower left, that's a bolt not tight on a breaker. Upper right, that's a breaker that's unhappy. Lower right, that's a fuse that's unhappy but hadn't had the good grace to blow yet, but it's thinking about it. Look outside with the drone camera while you're there. Is that little bolt on the pole pig? Yeah, it's going to fail. That was in a major market FM station, and you call Miss Utility. No, you call the tower. The company say help. AM stations, this station vexed my soul, and it was behaving badly, and we couldn't figure out easily what was going on. It was in this one branch, and you look around, and physical inspection saw nothing because, of course, the fault's going to be back behind what you can't see. Brought out an IR camera. Yeah, that's like 100 above what it should be. Took it out of the circuit, and you see the picture there. It was hot. It was splitting, but you couldn't see it, and it didn't go ahead and blow its guts, so you couldn't see tar everywhere. So going in and looking at your RF plant, you can see hot spots, a bad contactor, finger stock, the lower center one. That's an example. Here, the glowing around the coils and everything, that's kind of normal. That's a vacuum cap on the right. That left is the tapped coil, and even though it looks hot, that's a reflection of thermal energy from something else. But upper right, that contactor is about to go for you. So again, just walk around and look with a thermal camera and look at relative differences in what you're seeing. Now just some eye candy. Transmitter cooling pumps over here. They run hot. This is a Rode transmitter. So what I would do if I were doing this for a client for real as opposed to making something pretty is I'd scale the color range so that I could have a finer demarcation of what the color and the temperatures were. That's normal operation to just run that hot. And you can get the manufacturer of the pump. Okay, what's ambient temperature? What's pump temperature? And know if you're within limits. Beauty shot, RCA, BTA1, R3 tubes. This is cool. And the modulator, it's working harder, the one on the left. And again, inside of various transmitters showing stuff. Here is one of my guys taking a picture of a transmitter. It's a hot environment, but if you look where the little 30.3 mark is, that's a picture of a guy in a baseball cap with a thermal camera. That's his reflection, his heat reflection into a hot environment. So your body heat can distort the reading that you're taking. So it's again, take the FLIR courses on what you're looking at, what you're seeing, what is real temperature, what is reflected temperature, what is your imagination, what is a finish or color difference, because you can get the wrong answer really fast and that can be embarrassing. Just for fun, if you can get into your tubes while they're operating, you know, FM power tube there, that's a normal motor in the middle. Power transitions, obviously. Look at transformers. Yeah, that looks hot in the middle, and it is because you have two hot things facing each other, but if I saw a hotter spot, a focused spot, and that's again, you play with the colors and the temperature ranges to say, okay, is that normal or is that trouble? So again, IR stuff, whether it's drone mounted to inspect transmission lines or foot mounted to see what's in your plant, can be very, very powerful. One last thing. Physical stress can create a thermal signature. That tower section, that was in trouble, and it eventually it bent over there to the left, but there was a subtle heat signature there. This is a base insulator, God help us, that's the old KQV. Unenergized, nothing around it was energized, but it's just the stress, the physical stress. And you talk to a structural engineer, so yeah, that leg has a lot of pressure on it. And that's why you were seeing the thermal signature. Utility companies use this too to see if their poles and their tensioning devices are under too much tension. You can actually see those kind of troubles. So the thermal stuff is pretty cool to get into. What I keep harping on though is take a course, work with somebody who has the experience, and FLIR, if you buy something for them or you take the courses, they're often willing to talk to you on the phone and help you out. Yes, sir. DJI does make a thermal drone system now. I don't know that you can retrofit without a lot of creativity a thermal camera to your drone. You might, but it's sort of a field engineering job on your part. So you can take a thermal camera in and mount it, and maybe put it below your visual camera so it moves with it, and that's kind of a poor man's way of getting it done. So you can do that. We ponied up for a separate camera, an expensive DJI. So we have like two different ways of doing everything, at least. Any other questions? Come on, guys. You're engineers. You got to nitpick. Not even Welton. I'm heartbroken. So you guys are sleeping, is what it is. No other questions. No other heckling. Good. Heckle, please. Sorry to race through all this. We thought we could do it more efficiently. Yes, sir.
Just asking for your speculation, with the recent banning of DJI drones with the DoD, do you expect there to be any restrictions on using it on critical infrastructure?
Yes,
I'm seeing some of that.
Not yet.
But some places you don't see, it depends on who you're picking on. Power companies are getting allergic to it now. Military installations for sure. Other times people don't know what you're using. And if you do anti-product placement and put gaffer tape over the identification, DJI, maybe you can get away. I mean, I'm not advocating that, but you could. Yeah, you need to have a second way of doing something. If you're doing this professionally, get another drone. What was the name of the one that we got from New Zealand?
Aeronavics.
Aeronavics. The Aeronavics drone was, just so you know, relative prices.
Fully equipped with the RF. With the RF box and the computer and everything, the Aeronavics drone was about $70,000. By the time we finished monkeying with our home built, it was about that as well. And the DJI platform that we're currently using was $40,000 with everything on it.
So again, it's the drone and it's the device you're doing the measurement with. And if you're doing pattern measurements, you have to have an onboard receiver that talks to the drone to know where it is. And again, our drones have like three GPSs to cross-correlate where I am, and our height, and a barometer. All that there, talking to an onboard computer that then talks to something that sends telemetry down to our station and records it. So you're talking about a lot of electronics there. And sometimes it's better to build your own, other times you buy somebody else's. Yes.
Where's the best place to start if you're interested in getting licensed?
Believe it or not, the FAA.
The FAA has something they call the drone zone.
Well, that's waivers, but it's...
If you just Google FAA Part 107,
it's actually user-friendly.
The website's pretty user-friendly, and it's pretty good about, you know, taking you through the links to... And you can also... you can also Google Part 107 drone classes. There are a bunch of them online. Our guys took the one from a company called Gold Seal, I think.
Gold Seal was one. One of our guys took it from Drone Girl. It's just you sit through a bunch of classes. They prepare you for the test. It does cost money to take the test, but it's relatively easy, and it teaches you about regulation, drone safety, personal safety, FAA regulations about flying too close to stuff, weather. It's pretty comprehensive, but it can be done in a couple of weeks, depending on your beer cooler size. So, yes.
I have a question. You talked about RF hardened drones. If you had a half a megawatt TV station ERP, how close can you get to that antenna?
Close enough, but not too close.
We've gotten within 70 meters without anything falling out of the sky.
The answer is we'll fly the 400 foot circle.
RF hardened?
Yes.
I mean, what did you have to do to make your drone RF hardened?
Copper coat everything, put chokes and filters in everywhere. Toroids are your friend. Conductive tape is your friend. Carl? Yeah, community colleges, that's true. Oh, one other note, we're at zero, but there's a hint. Some jurisdictions do not like you flying drones at all. FLIR does not offer courses, I think it's in North Carolina, because there's a big, you can't take a picture of anybody else's property or them without their permission, so a lot of people just don't fly in North Carolina because of that. So be aware of your local laws and your state laws wherever you fly so you don't get some officer friendly coming up and busting you for breaking a law you didn't know existed. Check local laws and make sure when you're doing something that the station representative is there with you, preferably with a business card or a note that says, yes, you can do this. Because nothing worse than being, they call the station and nobody answers the phone, or they answer the phone, they don't know who the hell you are, so you know, off you go to the pokey. So you know, it's like any other field measurement job. Anything else? Well, bummer. Okay.